So when should Peter Piper pick those peppers to pickle? Well, our next guest has the answer. This is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And joining us for the first time is Lauren Landers. She's a master gardener, a writer, public speaker with over a decade of experience helping others learn about gardening, homesteading, and sustainable living. And you can find more on her blog, Zero Waste Homestead. Besides those peppers, we'll talk to her about what plants don't do well when they're planted together. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Join in with your questions by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
You bet. So I think a lot of people are in the position right now where those peppers are looking pretty good in the garden, but how do I know when to pick them? What's your advice for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. We definitely are approaching pepper harvest season right now. So it really kind of varies depending on the types of peppers you're growing, from bell peppers to spicy jalapenos.
Okay.
The first place to start would definitely be to look at your seed packets because, like I said, it varies depending on the type of peppers. Most seed packets will say it's about 70 to 85 days from the point of growing peppers from seed until harvesting. But that really varies depending on the type. And something like a Carolina Reaper, which is a super hot pepper, might take 150 days. Until it's ready to harvest, but that's just one way to really tell. And there, because a lot of things can vary depending on how the pepper is grown, the type of weather you're having, how much heat you're having, and that sort of thing.
Sure. Can you tell by looking at it?
Definitely. Days to harvest is just one piece of information, but a better way to judge is just to look at it. So the fun thing about peppers is they can be harvested anytime they reach a usable size. You can pick them when they're green or when they reach the ripen color. A lot of people don't realize that peppers will continue to develop color as they ripen. So there's a few things that you can look at. One is the size, if they're a usable size, but then the other thing is the color. So something like a jalapeno actually turns red when it's fully ripe, but they're usually harvested when they're green. Bell peppers can be picked when they're green, but a lot of bell peppers will turn yellow, orange, red, or even purple when they're fully ripe, and that really depends on the type of pepper you're growing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about the flavor, the hotness for those hot chilies and whatnot? The greener they are, the hotter they are, or the redder they are, the hotter they are? How does that work?
That's a good question. So it's actually, you're going to get sweeter and hotter peppers if you let them develop more color. But for something with a jalapeno, like a jalapeno, you're going to want to get it right when it's turning from green to red. That's the maximum heat level. They actually become sweeter as they turn fully red, and they lose some of the capsaicin content, which is what makes them hot. So you want to get jalapenos when they're green to red. Something like a habanero, you're going to want to wait until it reaches the mature color of orange. Like a banana pepper is hottest when it's yellow, bright yellow. So it really depends on what the mature color is supposed to look like.
And the color, I mean, even on bell pepper, the taste of a green one compared to, you know, when it gets red, yellow, what have you, is definitely different.
Right, yeah. So you're going to get a sweeter bell pepper if you pick when it is, whatever the mature color for the bell pepper you're harvesting. And something I like to do just to get, like, the most color and taste variety with my bell peppers is I'll harvest them when they're green and then freeze those and then wait for them to develop more color and then pick them at different stages of the ripening process. You get more colors but also more flavor variety.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And so when you plant your peppers, do you keep that in mind, that you'll be harvesting them as they go?
Yeah, and it might be helpful for some people just to kind of mark on their calendars when you put your peppers in the ground so you can kind of get an idea of when the harvest season is going to start, and then you can kind of plan when you're planning to harvest. And if you're growing a lot of peppers at once and you want to do some freezing, just kind of having that planned out too. And you can also get peppers a lot earlier if you start with nursery starts. rather than seed, if that's a goal.
Sure, absolutely. Well, one of the other reasons we asked you to stop by and talk to us today, Lauren, was we were going to talk about companion planting, kind of in the opposite of what we normally hear. But why don't you describe what companion planting is and what are some of the benefits of that?
Yeah, companion planting is one of my favorite topics to talk about. It's just so interesting. And I think more and more people are kind of realizing the value of companion planting. It's a really great thing to include if you're an organic gardener, because it offers just a lot of benefits to your organic garden. Or if you're growing conventionally, it's just a great tool to have in your gardening arsenal. So companion planting and the basic concept is just growing certain plants that get along well together in close proximity. And it has a lot of benefits. One of the main reasons why people do this is for pest control. So some plants will naturally repel pests, like something like a scented herb can keep pests from coming near your vegetables. But a lot of companion plants, especially ones with flowers, will also attract beneficial insects that will feed on garden pests. So that's one of the main reasons why people do companion planting, but some companion plants can also improve the growth or flavor of their neighbors. A good example of that would be basil combined with tomatoes. Legumes, which is beans and peas, can improve, can add nutrients to the soil, so you can actually reduce your need for fertilizers if you're growing those as companion plants. Plants can also provide shade, support in trellising, or even be used as a mulch if you're growing something like a ground cover. So it's just some of the main benefits of companion plants.
Right. Now, those are some good combos, but we can assume that there are bad combinations of plants. What are some of the things that can happen if we put incompatible plants together?
Yeah, so a lot of plants do really well together, and there's just, you know, a few companion plant pairings that just don't really go well together. And a lot of this comes down to plants not having the same growing condition needs. So if you grow something that needs a lot of sun or a lot of water near something that likes shade or drier soil, you're going to be one of those plants is going to be struggling very likely. You can also have problems if you grow aggressive plants together, like something like a mint can easily choke out other plants. There's also some plants like heavy feeding corn can compete with other plants for nutrients or space. And one of the main things that can happen is if you're growing plants that are closely related together, they can potentially increase pest problems or disease problems in your garden or even cross-pollinate. And then the final issue that can happen is something called allelopathy, and that is when some plants can actually suppress the growth of their neighbors. They secrete things into the soil that actually make other plants kind of struggle. So
sure.
Something to be aware of.
Well, let's talk about some of those bad combinations. Now, I saw you wrote a great article for Better Homes and Gardens, and you called out some of these combinations. So let's talk about some of those. The first one you had on your list was fennel, and it's not really, it doesn't like to share, does it?
It doesn't. It is one of the worst neighbors you can grow in your vegetable garden. That is one of the plants that is allelopathic to other plants, so it will actually suppress the growth of other plants nearby. And fennel does this to reduce plant competition, so it has more space to grow, but it can really affect growth of neighboring plants. So I always grow fennel in pots kind of near my garden because it's a great pollinator plant. And, you know, I like to harvest it for my own use, but I keep it directly out of my vegetable beds just because it can just be a hard one.
I had never heard that, so I was really surprised about that one, but it does make a lot of sense. So next we have our brassicas and strawberries. Now, brassicas, of course, are cauliflower, cabbage, what am I missing, broccoli?
Kale.
Kale, okay.
Yeah, collard greens.
Yeah, and strawberries. Now, thinking just the thought of those two together, like in my mouth, I was like, ew. But they're, other than that, I mean, what are some of the reasons why we don't want to put them together?
Well, at first glance, that might seem like an okay pairing in the garden because they both like rich soil and have a lot of water. But the main reason why you want to keep those two apart is because of pest issues. They tend to attract the same pests, and specifically cabbage loopers, which are tiny little caterpillars that really kind of flock to brassica plants. And if you have strawberries nearby, these cabbage loopers are going to hop on over to your strawberries and kind of ruin your strawberry crop too. So you just want to space those apart if you can.
For sure. Now, are there some things that do go well with brassicas?
Yeah. So brassicas, one of the best things to grow near them are alliums, which are garlic, onions, chives, anything in the onion family, because these alliums have naturally sulfur properties that they secrete, and they can actually make your brassicas more pest resistant. You can also grow something like a bean or pea in your brassicas because the legumes fix nitrogen into the soil, which helps brassicas grow better. So it's like a natural fertilizer.
Okay.
Whereas strawberries kind of grow well with lettuce or rhubarb, just a nice little pairing.
Oh, I've never thought about strawberries and rhubarb, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, great for pies.
Yeah, true. Absolutely. Well, that's kind of true with some of these combos that work, right? Is they taste good together, kind of like the basil and the tomatoes, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's maybe why they were paired together in the kitchen in the first place.
Probably. Now, here's another one that is not such a great pair. It's the cucumber and sage. Now, why should we separate these two?
Yeah, so the main reason why you want to keep those apart is watering issues. So cucumbers like a lot of water. You can kind of tell that by how much water the fruit contains.
Sure.
But sage is a Mediterranean herb. It does best in sandy, dry soil. So if you're growing those two together, there's a good chance that your cucumbers are either going to be underwatered or your sage is going to be overwatered and develop root rot. So you kind of want to stick sage with plants that prefer drier conditions. Sage also grows really well with brassicas just for a pest control standpoint, whereas cucumbers, a great one for them is his dill. Like we were saying, these taste pairings paired well together, but then dill also helps keep the pests off cucumber plants.
You know, my grandfather always planted dill with his cucumbers, and yeah, apparently he knew what he was doing.
yeah, smart.
Then we've got asparagus and alliums, which I think would be interesting to put those together. I think I guess I wouldn't have thought about it, but that's probably a good thing because they don't do well together.
Yeah, so finding plants that grow well with asparagus can be a little tricky because it's a slow-growing plant. It takes about 3 years to start producing spears, but you have to keep the asparagus fronds in place until then. So a lot of people tuck different vegetables in around asparagus plants, but alliums is just one you don't want to put in your asparagus bed, largely because alliums actually inhibit the growth of asparagus, so your asparagus plants are just not going to grow as well with alliums nearby. But because both of these are root crops, they can also compete with each other for soil space. And then when you go and harvest your onions, you could potentially also be disturbing your asparagus crown.
Oh, sure. Now, when you say close together, what are you talking about? A foot, 5 feet, 10 feet?
A foot or two of asparagus. So, like, a lot of these companion plant pairings, you can still grow these plants in your garden, mm-hmm. but you're going to want to space them out. I would recommend spacing them at least 2 to 3 feet apart, maybe putting a row of vegetable buffer in between. So grow something like a lettuce in between your onions and asparagus would be enough to separate that. Whereas something potatoes and tomatoes that can share the same pest, you want to kind of spread those out even further in your garden, maybe put them on opposite sides of the bed.
Oh, sure. Great. Our guest on Garden Talk today is Lauren Landers. She's a master gardener, writer, and public speaker. What questions do you have about companion planting? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry today. And join us next week on Garden Talk. We're going to get some advice from UW Extension horticulturist VJ Pandian. And then Susan Carpenter from the UW Arboretum is going to be in to talk about some great upcoming native plant classes. Right now, we are talking to Lauren Landers about some combinations of plants that don't do so great together. We just talked about asparagus and alliums. Don't do it. Up next, we're talking about corn and tomatoes. Now, that was a surprise for me. I thought those two would get together well. What's the problem there, Lauren?
Yeah, so corn and tomatoes are both really heavy feeding plants. So growing those two together can deplete your soil faster and increase the amount of fertilizer you need to use. But these plants also attract the same pest. It's called corn earworms on corn, but it's also known as tomato fruit worms on tomatoes. It's the same pest, but if you grow these two plants together, you're going to increase the pest problems in both of your plants.
Okay, we had talked about putting basil with tomatoes as a good combination. Mm-hmm. What about corn? Do we really can we put anything with corn?
Yeah, one of the most classic examples of companion planting is actually with corn. It's known as the Three Sisters planting method. It's created by the indigenous community, and this is you're pairing corn with pole beans, which is a climbing vining bean, and winter squash. So the corn serves as a trellis, a natural trellis for the climbing bean, and the bean improves the soil with nitrogen, while the winter squash around the base of these two plants serves as a natural mulch to insulate the soil, and also because winter squash has prickly leaves can keep something like a raccoon from eating your corn. It's great. Method.
Yeah, that is we can definitely look to indigenous people for really good advice when it comes
Absolutely.
To gardens, right? Have you grown the Three Sisters yourself?
I have. It did work well. I personally used purple potted pole beans, which I think are, I always have a really good success rate with them actually climbing up corn. So, and then I did some winter squash around the base, and I definitely noticed that they did better in that pairing.
That's great. I love that. So next up, excuse me, you have dill and carrots. Now, those are in the same family, right?
Yes, they are. They are both umbellifer plants. And that is kind of the reason why these two plants don't grow well together. One, because they're closely related enough that they can actually cross-pollinate with each other, which is mainly a problem if you're planning to collect your own seeds, because you can end up with seeds that just are not going to be tasty. But these two plants can also attract the same pests. So you're going to potentially end up with more carrot fly problems if you keep dill near your carrot, because the dill is actually going to attract more carrot flies.
So the dill goes right with cucumbers. What about carrots then? Is there something that works well with them?
Yeah, so growing sage near carrots can actually reduce carrot fly problems. Carrots also grow really well with radishes, which is something I personally like to do, because the radishes sprout a little faster than carrots, which can break up the soil and make it easier for carrot seeds to germinate.
That is an awesome idea, because we do get little short carrots a lot of the times, don't we?
Yeah.
Is that generally because the ground is too hard?
Usually, yes. There's a few things that can make small carrots. It could be the soil is too hard. It can be lack of water, not enough sun, or just not enough nutrients from the soil.
Okay. And then we've got grapes and cabbage. Now, I would never consider putting those two together, but obviously somebody tried it. So what happens when those two get together?
Yeah, so that is not just cabbage. Any brassicas really just don't do well with grapes. And a lot of that has to do with they're just heavy feeding plants, and they're going to compete with each other. Specifically, the brassicas are just not going to get enough nutrients really under a grapevine. So you're probably going to end up with undersized crops. With that, I would definitely recommend doing grapevines more with like a flower or some herbs, because those plants don't need as much fertilizer. And alliums and celery actually go really well with cabbage and other brassicas.
Oh, sure. That makes sense with that one. And we were talking about, you know, corn and tomatoes earlier, but what about potatoes and tomatoes?
Yeah, so these are both nightshades, and at first glance, you might think they should grow well together because they have the same basic needs and they're the same family. But this plant pairing doesn't work mostly because of pest issues. These plants both attract the same pests, like hornworms and potato beetles, and they're both heavy feeders. So if you keep them too close together, you're likely to end up with more pest problems and also maybe a smaller crop, because they're both competing for soil nutrients.
And next we've got rue and basil. Now talk about rue, because that's something that we don't grow too much of. What's it,
right.
What is it used for?
Yeah. So this is a less common, companion plant pairing. Rue is often used, now as a ornamental plant. It has these beautiful kind of feathery bluish green leaves. And it's also a great pollinator plant. You're more likely to see it in something like an ornamental garden, but it's also traditionally used as a medicinal plant. But it just does not grow well with basil. These two plants can actually inhibit each other's growth. So if you have basil, you'll just want to keep it far away from your room.
That is just amazing. Did you learn all this through trial and error, or do you have great reference sources?
A little bit of both. I have had a number of years to experiment in my garden, so I definitely have tried some of these pairings to my detriment. But I've also, there's some great resources on like cooperative extension websites for your local university that can list out like charts of just companion plant pairings to avoid.
And there are some good books out there too, so you can check that out as well. So we're talking with Lauren Landers. If you've got any questions about companion planting or vegetable questions, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And the last one on your list, this is a top 11, I think it was, right? Turnips with other root vegetables. Why don't they go together?
Some of this has to do with some root vegetables are going to have the same basic pests. So keeping some root vegetables together can increase pest problems. But also some root vegetables are going to also be competing with each other for soil space. And turnips is a big one because they're kind of one of the larger root vegetables. So you kind of want to space them out more. This is not a hard, fast rule because, like I said, I like growing carrots and radishes together. But you just want to make sure you're really following proper spacing guidelines on these and making sure you enrich your soil with compost or your fertilizer of choice before you're growing them so they have enough nutrients.
And there's a lot of information on those seed packets, aren't there?
Yes, there is. You can definitely find spacing recommendations and planting recommendations on seed mm-hmm. packets.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your blog? You're a homesteader, right?
I am. Yeah. So I started my homestead in 2018, and then I started the blog soon thereafter, kind of just to document the process of the beginning homesteader, as I learned kind of through trial and error what I was doing or doing wrong sometimes. Since then, Zero Waste Homestead has kind of evolved, includes some homesteading stuff, some canning recipes and gardening recipes, but I've also moved more into the rewilding world and pollinator gardening. So there's a lot of pollinator content and tips on how to rewild your yard and make it more wildlife friendly on my blog as well.
And it's zerowastehomestead.com if anybody wants to check that out. Lots of good information there. What got you interested in homesteading, garden, sustainability? What is it that pulled you in?
Yeah, so it really started, I bought my first homestead and it was it had been owned by a lady who knew a lot about gardening. And at the time I didn't know a lot about gardening, but I was very interested in rehabbing her old gardens. So I kind of learned a lot, kind of on the fly by trying to put her garden back together. And that taught me a lot. And then, I've always been interested in kind of conservation issues and living more eco-friendly. So while I was building my homestead, that was definitely an influential part of just learning how to reduce my impact.
Oh, certainly. And you're in Maine, is that right?
I am, yes.
Is that where you grew up?
No, I'm originally from Pennsylvania, okay. But I've been in Maine for a while. I did the Master Gardening Program through the University of Maine, so that has helped me learn more about gardening. But Maine does have some short growing seasons.
Yes, well, we can kind of relate a little bit here in Wisconsin,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
We got an email from Jane in Oregon, Wisconsin, and she loves doing companion planting, and she's done nasturtiums, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and winter squash. My tongue just doesn't want to wrap around that. And she said it's going really, really well, but she has a question. Can you suggest a good companion plant, either a flower or a vegetable, for potatoes? They have had a lot of beetles this year and hope to find something to put close by or in between to reduce the coal potato beetle.
Ooh, okay, that's a good one. So nasturtiums are actually a good one for potatoes. Sweet alyssum can be a good one, too. It's a small ground-covering plant with tiny little purple or white flowers. It attracts something known as a hoverfly, which is a tiny little fly that looks a bit like a bee. And these hoverflies can actually take care of a lot of caterpillar and grub problems. So if you're having a beetle problem, that's a good one to grow nearby.
So you must do a lot of work where you bring in natural, like a predator, to take care of the not so great bugs in your garden.
Yes, definitely. So I do keep an organic garden, and so that is largely why I use companion plants so much, because a lot of these plants are really great at attracting predatory insects like hoverflies, lacewings, ladybugs. Wasps are actually really great for that as well. And then beyond companion plants, installing some bird boxes or some bat houses in your garden can also really help to reduce pest issues.
Oh, that's a good one, too, is having those birds. They're great to look at. But, yeah, they do eat those.
They do, yeah. Very helpful to have around.
We were just talking with our guest beforehand about what she recommends for the winter garden, or not the winter garden, but going from fall into winter. And what do you not, should you cut everything down? Should you leave it? What do you do?
For vegetable gardens?
Yeah.
I have a mix of annual and perennial plants. I do have some perennial rhubarb and asparagus in my garden, so I obviously leave those in place. I let the fall frost kind of kill the plants, so I don't really remove much until then. And then I do pull out most of the annual vegetables at that point, because I found that that is one of the best ways to reduce pests and problems like powdery mildew, is just to do a good garden cleanup in fall. And then I usually burn the stuff that I remove instead of putting in the compost pile, just to make sure nothing's overwintering.
That was going to be my next question. Thank you for answering that. Lauren, it's been a joy to talk with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks for joining us again. We've been talking with Lauren Lander. She's a master gardener, writer, and public speaker. Want to thank our team here at the Larry Mueller Show, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaude, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and of course, Larry Mueller. I'm the executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and thank you so much for being with us. Hope you join us again.